we know that those who fought in the Vietnam War were not as welcomed and respected as our military personnel who return home today. But for some, it was very much a nightmare. In fact, one of today's guests was charged with a second-degree felony because he attempted suicide. Now, that sounds like it doesn't make any sense at all, but it happened to him, and we're going to find out more in just a moment. Hello, everyone. I'm Pamela Brewer, and I welcome you to this edition of Mind Talk. Today's guests are Dan Adair, and the co-author is Linda Gossin. Together, they have written Innocence Lost, the story of a Vietnam vet. Welcome, Dan. Welcome, Linda.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Dan, you describe yourself as, you are described in Innocence Lost as a, and I'm quoting now, a hillbilly raised in the West Virginia mountains, eating pinto beans and cornbread and feeling blessed. So, sounds like you had a kind of a laid-back, simple life. It was a simple existence.
Yes, I did. My dad was a coal miner, and my mother participated in the garden, mostly her in the garden. But we ate quite a few pinto beans, and we were just common old people. And I'm from a place called Welch, West Virginia. It's south, the southern part. But we were in the coal mining area, and it was quite a poor area.
As you were growing up, what did you imagine your life would be like?
Actually, everybody in the area, unless you worked in a filling station or a funeral home, I would say coal mining was about the only thing you had. And I'd never been out of West Virginia at the time, basically because my parents couldn't afford it. They were raising a family of their own, including me. But I just kind of enjoyed the atmosphere of the Appalachian Mountains.
And who did you grow up with, Dan?
I had two sisters or one sister, whichever in the book. But I just more or less, when you're up there, it's like playing cowboys and Indians, and you're the cowboy Indian, and then you have to shoot it yourself and pretend that the cowboy shot you or whichever, because houses were very far away from each other. And a trip to the grocery store was a highlight of the week.
So, again, clearly you didn't have any sense that your life was going to be what it ultimately became. There was a time you went to school, you graduated high school, and Linda Gossin, the co-author of Innocence Lost, the story of a Vietnam vet. I'm going to ask you, Linda, to chime in whenever it seems reasonable for you. For Dan, there was a time after graduating high school, and you got a letter and kind of left your folks a little bit concerned. Tell us about that letter.
Well, I didn't actually know about the letter until late in the afternoon. My mother always, it was an adventure to be able to go to the letterbox and get a letter, because back in Sears and Roebuck magazine was the biggest thing, whichever. But once she got the letter, she hid it from me. She read it, and she realized, you know, the content, and she didn't absorb it very well. And late that afternoon after supper, she handed me the letter during supper, as a matter of fact, and told me not to read it right now, to wait till later. Some moments later, maybe a half hour or so forth, as I read it, I just sat on the edge of the bed, and she walked in, and she had a few tears in her eyes that she had actually raised a son. I was an only son, and now that somewhere around 3 weeks after graduation, he receives a draft notice with Vietnam going wide open.
So that's kind of, to put it mildly, a huge deal, certainly a shock. And it's interesting the way the letter was crafted, because they essentially said that if you don't show up, we're coming to get you. Have a great day.
Well, that's the way they operated back then. I didn't have a choice to go to Canada or anywhere else. Transportation was basically at a zilch, and all Dad had was a Jeep, and I wasn't going to Canada anyhow, because he had he'd served in World War II, and he'd got a Silver Star from it. But it was my obligation to the family to hold up the name and do what I was supposed to do, so I did so.
You, at when you left, just before you left in high school, you know, so many people typically think of high school as the time when you, much to your parents' chagrin, you're trying all kinds of new things, you are going to parties, you're dating, you're doing all the things that your parents wished you wouldn't. Did you do any of those things?
No, because like I said before, we were a poor family. We lived on top of the mountain, and just to catch a school bus every morning was a venture for us. But as far as parties and so forth, no, it was more or less a humble life, and that's the way we lived it. And actually, that's all we could see was living in the mountains and working in the coal mines, I guess, was the only thing we seen in our future.
So, you know, again, it was a quiet life. It was a peaceful life. It was a predictable life. And then comes this letter, and shortly after, you're on a bus, and you're on your way to Fort Benning, Georgia, and boot camp. I would imagine that was difficult for the entire family.
My mom and dad, they drove me to the bus station, which was 25, 30 miles away. But during the meantime, while I was on that, in the back of the Jeep, we only had that Jeep, as I say, and there wasn't quite, there was hardly any conversation at all, because the end result was the bus that was going to haul me off. And as we arrived at the bus station, after sitting in there for a couple of minutes waiting on the bus, I just decided to get out and look around and so forth. And Mom had pulled out a picture of a family picture that out of her purse. I don't know where she'd got it from. I don't recall ever seeing it before, but as I loaded on the bus, she handed it to me along with a small Bible and said, "Never go astray from the Bible." We were church-going people. She said, "Never go astray from this Bible, and here's a picture that we just want to see you home again. We don't know what's going to happen, but take care of yourself."
You know, that's an interesting comment from your mom as you were headed off to boot camp and ultimately to a war where your life was about to change 360 degrees and then some.
Yes, it was, and believe it or not, I'd never really been out of West Virginia, and to be able to see different parts of the country was good, but I had the feel of adventure from getting away, but also had the feel of returning back and helping Mom and Dad out and so forth. And I don't know, I had to do what I had to do, but it gave me another look at life itself.
Dan, as you and I are talking, you and Linda both heard me introduce you both as authors of Innocence Lost. Why is Linda in the mix here?
Well,
what happened, Dan had written part of this book, and he came to me and he said, "I'm just a West Virginia hillbilly. I don't know how to put this in the proper words, the proper terms, the proper English." And he was in the process of writing the second part of the book. And I said, as a good friend of his, I said, "I will be more than happy to help you." So it's really his story, but a lot of it is my words, putting it into the prose that would be good for putting into print.
May I also add something there?
Certainly.
That was all true, and there was one catch also that I'd like to add. When I was, after I was sentenced, I was sent around to the courthouse to receive papers or information to where to report to the probation officer and what days and so forth. And after, as that conversation was ending, the clerk there informed me that if I ever in my lifetime inherited anything up to a total of $82,000, that the state of Florida would take it off of me for court costs. And I felt if this book did make anything, I definitely didn't want to donate it to the state of Florida for what they've just done to me.
I can certainly understand that. And we're going to go into that into more detail in just a bit. Let me also add that Linda, it seems like, was actually a perfect person to be involved in this project, because Linda actually taught in Baltimore County, Maryland. So, Dan, I think you made a good choice.
I couldn't have picked a better person in my life.
Dan, let's go back to what was going on for you. What was your first impression when you arrived at boot camp in Fort Benning, Georgia?
Well, the first thing they said, the busload of people soon to be soldiers was hit the ground. Well, grass don't grow on a busy street, and the ground was sand. And they started their push-up ordeal, and a lot of things were said there, like you see on the movies sometimes. I knew I was in for a new adventure, and I was just praying to God I could make it through it.
I do understand that. It's a stark announcement, if you will, that your life was about to be forever different.
It was different, and after I'd succeeded the training in Fort Benning, I was then sent to Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri, for advanced training, which made me a wheel vehicle mechanic. Now, I'm going to tell you something. Dad never let me work on a Jeep, and I didn't have anything else to work on. I didn't know anything about working on it. And they graduated me, but like I say, I didn't know a 7/16. But they sent me to Gelnhausen, Germany after that to be a mechanic, and I didn't even work on wheel vehicle mechanics. I turned out to be a tank mechanic, and it was cold over there. Good Lord, I thought West Virginia was cold, but Germany was, was it cold over there. But as I was there, it was all spit shine. The military liked the soldier to look good, and of course, was in a different country and everything. But there was a Vietnam vet to come around it shortly afterwards, and he had the patches and battle scars and everything. He gave us a little conversation one day, and as we listened to him, a group of us, I looked at that fella and I said, you know, this ain't where I'm supposed to be. I don't like spit shine anyhow. And Dad had done what he had done in service, so I volunteered to go to Vietnam. I didn't have to go to Vietnam because I was an only son. But I did, and Uncle Sam granted that request 30 days later, and I was sent back home for a 30-day vacation, and then I was sent to the Vietnam Air.
You, 30 days after talking to this individual, you received your orders for Vietnam. 30 days later, then you had 30 days to be home, and then you were off to Vietnam. What preparation, what specialized training, how did the military prepare you for this entirely new venture?
They didn't prepare us at all, to be quite frank with you. They showed us films of what women can do to dismantle a soldier while he's over there, stuff like this, but as far as prepping gave us nothing. And I'd like to mention also, I thought, you know, or anybody would think, if you're going to a battle zone, you'd be going over to C-130 and be strapped down and all this other stuff. They gave us jungle fatigues to wear, and we boarded a TWA flight and landed in Cameron Bay in a TWA flight. And I said, good Lord, what is this here? But when we got off that plane, it was, well, the captain on the plane said, fellas, he said, I didn't fly here to stay here. He said, the sooner you get off, the faster I can go home. So he knew he was in hot territory, too.
You know, I almost don't know what to say, because it's just so stunning. And we know these things happen. We certainly know more now today than we did then in terms of what the experiences were like in Vietnam and just war in general. But it really is stunning on so many levels to send a youngster. And by the way, how old were you?
At that time, I was 18.
A youngster.
I spent two birthdays in Vietnam. I actually moved up to the rank of buck sergeant. When I went over there from Germany, I was a private one stripe. And as soon as I got there going into a combat zone, I got an extra loop underneath it, which made me a PFC. But my two tours over there, when I left, I ended up as a buck sergeant, and that was pretty high rank. But I turned 20 January the 1st of 1971. And February the 16th of 1971, I was discharged in Fort Lewis, Washington, and they wanted me to reenlist. I looked at them and I said, you know, I don't know, what do you got in mind? They said, we're going to make you a drill sergeant in Fort Benning, Georgia. And I said, really? And they offered me a sum of money, and actually they offered me another stripe to put on in the three I had. And I thought to myself, I said, self, the good Lord seen you through two tours over there, and other than being mentally affected, you were in good shape. Do not accept that. And I didn't accept it. I got out of service.
And that sounds like it was an excellent decision for you. And at that point, you were married, yes?
Yes, the first year I was over there, after it was about 2 weeks before I was supposed to come home, and the company clerk knew I didn't like this service. So I don't know why, I just wasn't adapted to it, I guess. He said, hey, Adair, he said, we can offer you early out if you'll sign up to come back here for 6 months, because we need combat veterans over here that know what's going on. And he said, I'll give you a couple nights to think about it. So I thought about it, and I said, you know, I do dislike the military, and I'd like that early out. So I signed up, and they gave me a 30-day vacation to come home. And that's when I met my wife. We had went to high school together, and she had wrote several letters, and we just got hitched together, and after 30 days was up, I didn't want to go back to Vietnam, but matter of fact, I was thinking about going AWOL, but I didn't do it. I went on back and served the other term, but the second term I was over there was quite different than the first term. It had a lot more, it was hotter. It was hotter, not even weather-wise, and that's what twisted my mind so much.
Dan, we're going to take a break. I'm speaking with Dan Adair and Linda Gossin. Linda is the author of Innocence Lost, The Story of a Vietnam Vet. Dan is the Vietnam vet about whom this story has been written. My name is Pamela Brewer. You're listening to Mind Talk. We are going to return in just a moment, so stay right where you are. Thank you. Dan, tell us, give us a mini picture of what your life was like in Vietnam.
Well, I was I was sent over to be a wheel vehicle mechanic, and after, I'd say, 3 weeks of the guys getting to know me and everything, because when you're a new person, they look at you for a long time to try and figure out if you're who they need over there. That's the people that's actually, I'll put it to you this way, I was in a helicopter medevac unit, which is better known as a dust off, and our mission was to go out and pick up under any condition, I'm talking about whether they were receiving fire or had received fire, any injured soldier, any condition we had to go get them guys, and we weren't afraid to do it. And after the third week, one of the crew chiefs, which maintains the choppers, come over to me and he said, hey Gary, do you really want to go and find out what Vietnam is about? I said, yeah, I do. I said, turning these wrenches ain't doing nothing. And he said, well, get you a flak jacket, and I'll have a helmet and everything, and I see you got an M79 grenade launcher there, which actually fires grenades at short distances. Bring that with you, and we're going to take a flight today. So I went on that flight, and when you go into an LZ, a landing zone, you don't know what to expect. There is no way that you can expect what's going to happen while you're in that LZ picking up that patient. But one shot from that M79, if we were receiving fire, which we did several times, would kind of obstruct the enemy to where they would either run for to hide, or that 1 second could save your life of that round coming out in M79. So after I proved that I was what I was supposed to be, I was approached by more. We had 6 helicopters in our unit. I was approached by more helicopter crew chiefs, and basically that turned out to be my steady job, other than working on trucks, because trucks hardly ever broke down anyhow. They weren't very good, but what could you do if something's already wore out?
Well, that's very true. But, you know, it really is, you know, I think I keep using the word stunning, but it really is stunning to think about a young kid, which is exactly what you were. You go there to be a mechanic, which you knew nothing about, and then all of a sudden you're in a helicopter and you're dead in the fire of what's going on, literally, of what's going on. And you were picking up bodies and fighting for your own life as you're picking up bodies in all kinds of conditions, yes?
That's very true. War is war, and the people that were over there, the South Vietnamese, they didn't want us over there. They hated us. Anybody that's been to Vietnam will tell you the same story about what I'm saying. They were as dangerous as the Viet Cong were, because actually their little boys and so forth were South Vietnamese, but they would mark off or walk off the huge distances during the day so that at night the mortar fire would come in. When I first got there, there were 3 howitzers real close to the hooch I was supposed to stay in. And I didn't know anything about war. And it was about 10 o'clock at night. I was laying in my bunk trying to fight the mosquitoes off of me. And one of them howitzers went off. And I'll tell you what, the earth shook. It was loud. I jumped out of bed, and the other guys come over and they said, "Calm down, man. So you're going to have to get used to that. That goes on all night long. They're calling in them rocket or the shells into the mountains. That's where they're receiving fire." And after the shells would go off, or during it, then you'd hear the helicopter picking up to go pick up whoever we was trying to bomb, because they were already got
someone out there. It was a horrible experience.
So again, you're a youngster in every way that matters. You don't know what conditions you're going into, except you know that they're dangerous and you might not come back. You're picking up bodies in all manner, literally, of disrepair and bringing them back. So each run to and from, you know that your life could be taken at any moment. Is that a fair picture?
That is a fair picture. Can I elaborate on one mission that we had over there on the second tour?
Absolutely.
I was laying in the bunk at about 3 o'clock in the morning, and the fire guard or clerk, whichever was in charge of taking care of the radios that night, come over and he said, "Hey, Dare, we got a hot mission." He said, "You don't have to go, you know, you are a volunteer." And he said, "But I believe them boys on that, or the guys, I call them boys, the guys on the chopper would certainly appreciate your company." And they gave us about 3 minutes to get dressed and be on the chopper. And as I left the hooch, I heard the blades already popping. And it was monsoon season. It was raining so hard you couldn't see 10 foot in front of you. And I got on board with my grenade launcher, and of course I was had my vest on and so forth and so on. And you have a helmet on those choppers where you can they talk to each other and so forth at radio contact. And I looked to my left as that chopper took off, which we really couldn't fly very well because you couldn't see anything. The windshield was covered up with rain. So I looked to my left, and we flew by instrument, by the way. And I looked to my left, and there was a Cobra gunship out there. Now, Cobra in Vietnam is a bad boy. I looked to my right, and there was another one, and I said, "Good Lord, this is a hot mission." So when we went out, we flew up into the mountains from the base. And when we got there, like I say, it was pitch dark. And, of course, the helicopters over there have lights on them that are brighter than a football field when they turn them on. But when we went in, it was so hot, both Cobras went in and unleashed whatever they had to unleash. And then we were called in to get the patient. And it didn't turn out to be an LZ at all. There was no place to land. The jungles were so tall and so thick that we had to hover over top of the mountain, over top of the trees, and drop a basket, a steel basket, down, cable operated, down through a hole they'd cut in the limbs. And we had to hold there for about 10 minutes to get this patient, knowing that within 15 or 20 minutes prior to that, that was the only reason we was there, because somebody, Charlie, had come in and done a bad job on us. And I'll tell you what, people can say anything they want to. When you're hovering in the air with monsoon rain, and we even saw monkeys in trees at this time, they were so, what's going on here? You know, let's go over and join the party stuff. But when you're in the air, you think of mom, you think of dad, you think of your life, you think of your wife, you think of your girlfriend, but if we'd have got shot out of the air, which God bless we didn't, they'd have got two pilots, a crew chief, a medic, and a patient protector, and a Huey helicopter. Now, if they wouldn't have got an attaboy for that when they went back in their tunnels, something would have been wrong. But if we'd have got shot out of the air and us in a position or of a place in Vietnam, we didn't have road maps. How was we going to find our way back to base? And knowing that that chopper had been shot and went down, they did give you a pill that was sewn into your uniform on your shoulder, that if you got shot down, you had the choice to take that pill and get it all over with, or try and make your way back to base. Boy,
only we didn't get shot down, this was the conditions we were living under.
And these were daily conditions. You never knew when the moment was your time to be your last moment.
Never, never, never. I spent more time in a bunker when I first went there. Some order rounds coming in. That was the first 2 or 3 weeks I was there. Than I did in the hooch at night. And finally, one night, that siren, the voice sent the siren off. I said, "Hey, there, or Danny," I said, "why even bother? If it hits there, they're going to get you anyhow." So, but Vietnam was a strange place. You had to find your own relaxation or your way out of reality, which everybody knows that marijuana and stuff was going on over there. Mom and Dad raised me not to do none of that stuff, but I'll tell you what, after a while, you change your mind, if you know what I'm speaking of.
You know, as I'm listening to you and I'm hearing, I think it's birds in the background, and I'm imagining you, when you were in Vietnam, you weren't hearing birds in the background. You were hearing grenades in the background. You were hearing bombs in the background. It's just so different.
Well, as far as the book goes, that's what I can't understand. After 13 years of psychiatric treatment and my son moving into my house hooked on methamphetamine, been there for 5 years, 36 years old, and my wife leaving my bedroom for 10 years and me more or less becoming a drinker, I decided to commit suicide because I asked her for a change to get him on his feet again. And I would bring home application after application, but nothing ever happened. But after I'd attempted suicide, I cannot figure out how a judge can sit down and put the gavel down to a combat veteran that has been through what I've been through, and I don't know how many other veterans out there are being mistreated also, but how could he lay a gavel down to a 15-year second-degree felony charge without even asking a prosecuting attorney or the public defender about some type of background? I was 63 years old. I wasn't a guy that's running the streets with a bicycle or a skateboard or whatever. I had a lot of experience behind me. Why didn't he ask any of these things? It was on a Friday afternoon, and I was the last person in front of him. And I kind of figured, you know, maybe that's why he did it. He had to go home and enjoy the weekend. While he went home and enjoyed the weekend, the rest of my life had been ruined.
And just to go back for a moment, when you did return home from Vietnam at the age of 20, you couldn't vote, you couldn't find a job, there were no services for you, and in fact, you returned home to a country that was pretty annoyed about Vietnam to begin with. So there was literally no support for you, and who's surprised that drinking became a part of the way, yes, we know unhealthy, but drinking became a part of a way of life for you just to get through the next moment?
Drinking was actually a norm. In the service, everybody goes to drink. I mean, if you don't go to drink, you're not. I'm just telling how the service is. Everybody has a drink in the service. So to me, it was nothing new to go to a bar or you know, try and get a drink. And my brother-in-law, I was home about 5 days. He said, Danny said, "Let me take you over to the bar. I want to have a drink and, you know, just talk for a while." I went in there, and the bartender looked at me, and this was a country bar. She says, "Son, how old are you? Son, how old are you? Can I repeat that again? Son, how old are you?" Mm-hmm.
I looked at her and I said, "Well, I'm 20 years old." She said, "Well, you're not drinking in this bar. You gotta be 21 to drink in this bar." And that embarrassed the heck out of me, especially with everybody I'd already spent the day with working.
Right.
Which this was over a year. Well, no, I'm starting to get things confused. But it stuff like that. The only job, the first job I got when I got out of service was picking weeds out of a flower bed in Marineland, Florida. I worked 13 jobs the first year I was out. I drove from Michigan to Indiana to Chicago to Florida, back and forth. I could not get settled down. I don't care. I worked one job 3 hours. I just couldn't. The jobs that I got were not, they were make it through the week jobs. They weren't jobs you could, because nobody wanted you. You didn't know anything. Now, why would they want to hire a 20-year-old man that was driving tanks in Germany and in helicopters in Vietnam?
Yeah.
They didn't have a place for you.
So there were absolutely, again, to repeat, no supports for you. In fact, a withdrawal of the supports that you had while you were in Vietnam, and those supports weren't the healthiest ones, but you had comrades. You had people who were a part of your family, so to speak, and now you're back with your family, and everything's different, everything's changed, and it doesn't sound like you received any psychiatric support when you returned.
Not in the beginning.
There was none whatsoever. It wasn't even offered. PTSD really, in my opinion, my opinion only, I don't think PTSD was actually discovered until 9/11. That's when I seen people relating back to experiences they couldn't live with, nightmares. I noticed this is odd, but before that happened, I never seen an American flag hardly fly anywhere except at courthouses and stuff like that. The next morning, or let's say 3 or 4 days later, I seen more American flags attached to roll-up windows that you could buy at Walmart or CVS or whatever. Everybody had one. I said, well, why did it take so long and such a drastic event to take place to get America to wake up and realize the freedom that they are living in?
And PTSD is post-traumatic stress disorder, which include, well, I'm not going to go through what some of the things were that you were experiencing. Give us a sense of just a couple of the symptoms that you experienced as a result of, well, not as a result of PTSD, but as a result of being in a war zone, under attack on not a daily basis, but a second-to-second basis. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we will continue the conversation with Dan Adair and Linda Gossin, authors of Innocence Lost, The Story of a Vietnam Vet. Before you tell us some of the things that you were experiencing, I just want to ask Linda Gossin. You have co-authored Innocence Lost. You're listening now today as Dan is recounting what you've already heard probably 1,000 times as author of Innocence Lost. What's it like for you even today now as you're listening to Dan recount his experience?
You're right. I did, of course, read the book quite a few times doing the editing, and I finally said to him, this has to be the last time because it hurts so much to go through what you went through. I think the statement that he made in the book when he came back was that he wasn't the same John Reed, which is the name in the book, who had gone over there. Some people came back with physical battle scars you could see, but he was scarred on the inside, and people didn't see that. And he had such trouble relating to his wife because she expected the person who had gone over to be the person who came back, and he wasn't at all. And yeah, it is. It's difficult listening to this. It really is.
Dan, tell us some of the things that you experienced prior to your attempt to kill yourself.
My experiences, the first experience that probably connected me with PTSD was when I came home and Mom made a big dinner for me. And of course my wife was there, I was there, my dad was there, Mom was there, along with the sisters. And I looked at that dinner, and it had, it was turkey, green beans, coleslaw, whatever. And I looked at it, and after she had said the grace, I just got up from the table and started to walk off. And Dad followed me to the door, and he said, son, what's wrong with you? You're not the same boy you was when you left here. Well, about that time, I started, which I'm about to right now, just trying to remember the things that took place. I started crying because I couldn't actually remember how many times that I was in Vietnam and how many times I would pray to be able to sit down to a table with Mom and Dad and my wife and eat a meal like that. And it just flashed right in my face, and I couldn't handle it, so I left the room. And another thing that took place, this was in Vietnam, but before this suicide attempt took place, I couldn't handle my son. I have three children, two boys and a girl, and my oldest son succeeded. And my youngest son was doing real well, and all of a sudden, he gone on meth. And with him living in the house, the things that a person goes or does when they're on that drug is something that should not be spoke about on the radio. But she kept asking me or confronting me with things that he had promised her he would do, which he would not do. He started stealing everything else, but on top of PTSD, which I'd already had, now I had this other load upon me. And actually, my family started shunning me. They started, my daughter would come see me from a distance away or whatever. And I was in my man cave, my garage. She might come out 2 minutes and say, hello, Dad, how are you doing, and leave. But yet she would have private conversations in the house with my wife. It just got to me, and I said, you know, I prayed to the Lord one day. I went to get my beer, and I was coming back, and I said, Lord, there's got to be another life. This ain't the life that I've chosen. And I did that more than one time, but that afternoon I told her we was going to have a conversation about this and bring it to an end. She decided to go with him. And as they left the house, I'd prayed enough, I'd cried enough, I went through everything a man should not have to go through. And I went in the bedroom, got my pistol, and came out, put it under my chin, and pulled the trigger.
Again, a stunning, sadly understandable experience decision for you. You were drinking, as I recall, what was it, 18 cans of beer a day? Something like that?
I got to where I didn't even want to see life anymore. All I wanted to do was drink myself until I'd go to bed and go to sleep and wake up the next day in the hope that things would change, but they never did.
So clearly, in a profound, in a major depression, suicidal thoughts, ultimately a suicidal action. So clearly, the suicide attempt was unsuccessful. So the folks who are listening now are saying, well, okay, he tried to kill himself, but clearly he was depressed. So clearly, at that point, he would get some help. How could he not? What help did you get?
Can I tell you the help I got?
Please do.
I was, after I'd been released from the hospital, I was Baker-acted into a center for 6 weeks where I received psychiatric treatment. And after the 6 weeks was up and the main doctor had signed me off to leave, I said, well, good, I can go home. Well, it didn't turn out that way. They said, no, we're afraid we had to contact Marion County Sheriff's Department upon your release and hold you here until they get here. Well, about 3 minutes later, I walked over to the glass door, and there was two sheriff officers there waiting on me. They placed me against the wall, read me my rights, handcuffed me, and put me in their car. Took me to jail. On the way to jail, I said, wait a minute here. What am I going to jail for? What did I do? What's the charges? They said, probable causes. What? There is nothing called probable causes. It didn't have a direct line anywhere. But anyhow, after they booked me, they put me in a 10 by 10 foot cell for 4.5 months. With three other inmates that were rotated accordingly as to their behavior. I was fed through a steel door with a styrofoam plate that I had to tear up to eat whatever they could conveniently give to me. I was strip searched twice a day, 7 days a week. I had to sleep on a concrete floor, two showers a week and two phone calls a week, and may God be with you if someone had even picked up the phone on the other end, because it said this is from the correctional facility here in Marion County. It's going to cost you $15 to answer this phone. I finally found out after I took the plea bargain that they really didn't care about me to begin with, but the catch is, every month that I go to the probation officer, the last thing that I hear before I walk out that door, this is monthly, is make sure you got your $52 monthly payment in. That's, I don't hear anything about, are you doing better? How's life going? It's make sure you got that payment in the mail.
Okay, so let's just back up a second, because I know people are saying, wait a minute, I'm sure I missed something. You attempt to kill yourself, you go to the hospital, you go to rehab, and then you get arrested and charged with what?
Probable causes.
Right. I don't think there's a charge like that.
I don't either. That's what I couldn't understand. They put me in there to hold me until they could come up with a charge. And then when I went to my first appearance judge, my wife and son showed up and protested against me. So he looked at me, the judge did, and said, Mr. Adair, I'm not going to give you bail or bond. He said, what do you want, a lawyer or a public defender? At that time, my wife stood up and said, a public defender, Your Honor, we cannot afford a lawyer. I was on 100% disability. With a check, monthly check coming in, the judge looked at me and said, a public defender it will be. He didn't ask me. He didn't ask me. He didn't investigate my income, anything at all. He
appointed me a public defender, and I will tell anybody in this United States, if you get a public defender and you drop a popsicle stick on the sidewalk, you're going to jail, because a public defender to me is useless. I'm sorry, but that's, I'll tell you why. I was in there 2 months in that 10 by 10 foot room before I even knew a public defender's name was supposed to represent me. Then, after going to the in front of the judge with the plea bargain I finally had to take, she stood there, and the prosecuting attorney was laying me out like I was. He even told the judge or pointed the question at me. He said, "Mr. Adair, you're so stupid, you don't even know how to commit suicide correctly."
What?
And I went, "What in the world has this got to do with it?" She didn't protest nothing. And the only reason I got out under a plea bargain, I was after 4.5 months, I was sent into a place called, a bigger cell. And I said, "You know, I ain't getting out of here if I don't do something." So I went and contacted. I sent message after message for her, "Please get in touch with me." After I wrote a message that I was willing to take the plea bargain, the next morning she showed up. Now, ain't that ironic? And that's how the judge, but when I was, after I got sentenced, after I'd agreed to take the plea bargain and get out of jail, because I wasn't getting out of jail any other way, and the gavel went down, she leaned over my shoulder, my prosecuting attorney leaned over my shoulder and said, "Mr. Adair, I didn't even get a chance to look over your case. If I would have, I'm sure I could have got the charges dropped."
Dropped. And did she ever tell you what the charges were ultimately? I mean, you with the plea bargain, you were, will you tell us, what was the result of the plea bargain?
The plea bargain, which ended up as the charges, was firing a firearm inside a dwelling within the city limits. One shot was fired, which went in my head, in my own house, with nobody else in the house but me. The other charge was illegal exhibition of a deadly firearm, and the other charge was shooting myself while I was drinking. The first two charges dropped off a year later. Oh, by the way, I was in there 7.5 months. When I was charged with 15 years, that 7.5 months did not come off the 15 years. But the first two charges dropped. The third charge will be there until I'm 79 years old.
And the charge, it's a felony charge, yes?
Yes. I don't understand. Where can they get a felony charge for attempted suicide?
And with a felony charge, you can't vote. It's got to be impossible to get a job. There are all kinds of things that fall away from you in terms of options with a felony charge.
Well, in addition to the felony charge, a attachment was added with no contact with my family or to come within my house of 1,000 feet for 15 years. Well, when I got out of jail, I had to live in a motel room for 2 or 3 nights just to survive, which cost me, I had to go to the bank, have all kind of money re-transferred, because she had received my full disability check plus my Social Security for, if you add the 7.5 months I was up in jail and the 6 weeks I was in the center, she got 9 months worth of payments, and I still to this day don't know what happened to them. But finally I got a motel or an apartment I could rent, and my probation officer seen me at the motel regularly in the 3 days. He had to make sure that I wasn't some kind of lunatic, I guess. But I asked him when he come there, I said, "Buddy," I said, "you know, I finally got a place to rent. I'll be going in there tomorrow." I said, "I know you'd be there. Don't wear your badge over there, because if you do, they'll probably throw me out of the place. They'll look me up on the internet." You know what he did? He came out. He was there at daylight. He didn't wear his badge. God bless him, he didn't. But he had his pistol on his belt. Hello.
Gotcha.
Which one first? You understand where I'm coming from?
I do. Let me ask you this. You keep talking about full disability and Social Security. At that time, how much money were you getting a month?
To be honest with you, she had just got her Social Security, too, ironically enough, about 8 months before that. We were making $5,700 a month, clear money, and she could not get me an attorney.
Wow.
She inhaled, she inhaled $46,000 off of me while I was in jail. And when I got out, she sued me for divorce after I took her off the bank account that she wouldn't give me any money. And I had to get all the printouts from the bank and so forth and so on. She had, 12 credit cards? She had 12 credit cards maxed out at $79,000. Three of them had my name on it. The rest of them she had co-signed for, and she was trying to stick that to where I'd have to pay for all them too.
What is your life like today?
Right now, it's great. I couldn't ask for a better life. With matter of fact, I married Linda, and we have a nice home that we have pulled through this thing with. And other than a cloud hanging over, every morning, every single morning that I wake up, the first thing clicks in my head is probation. I have a cloud over my head for the rest of my life to fight for a country, for my freedom that I felt I deserved and worked for or fought for has been taken away from me.
And you've got an $80,000-some-odd bill that you're supposed to pay Florida to reimburse them for prosecuting you.
If I ever receive anything, but let me add something to that. I've already paid $14,000. They put a lien on a house I had that I was going to sell, and I had to pay them $12,000 before I could sell the house. Then I had to pay them $50 a day while being in jail for 7.5 months, which added up to the other. And that's not even including the $52 a month I have to pay for probation for 15 years.
Dan, how do people get more information about you, about Innocence Lost? We, unfortunately, are out of time today, but I know that listeners want to know more about your story.
There is a website. It is innocencelost.us.
Okay, terrific. Innocencelost.us. All right.
Correct.
Linda Gossin, Dan Adair, authors of Innocence Lost, The Story of a Vietnam Vet. I encourage you all to go to that website to get more information, innocencelost.us. Thank you both so much for joining us today.
Thank you
so very much, so very much. May God bless.
And folks, thank you for joining me today on this edition of Mind Talk. You can listen on demand to Mind Talk at mindtalk.org. That's mindtalk.org. You can also download the Mind Talk app from your iTunes or Google Play Store. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications. I'd love to know where in the world you are listening today, so do send an email to me at pamela@mindtalk.org. That's PAMELA at MYNDTALK.ORG. I'd love to hear your questions or comments about this or any other Mind Talk program. And again, the way to get more information about today's conversation is by going to innocencelost.us. And remember always, if it's unacceptable, then it is unacceptable. You take care.